by Deck Link interlocutors to the TechNet. This is TechNet number 1257 of the series that began in September of 1982. Most Sunday evenings, Mel and Dick get together, gather the clan, and we attempt to answer people's questions on the subjects of ham radio or subjects of interest to ham radio operators. Not always are the subjects exactly ham radio subjects. Occasionally, because ham radio operators are interested people with reference to radio, in particular wireless technology, computers, high-definition television, and things like that. We discuss any of those subjects. Almost any subject along those lines is appropriate for the TechNet. A person signs into the TechNet because he has a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name because I'm so darn forgetful. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Did you all right to be listening?
WB2QEQ, when?
WB2OMW, Rob, and yes.
And 2EO, Rich, and no, just listening.
WE2RAS, yes.
And Mr. RAS, you didn't give us your name, sir.
Oh, forgetting already. And the handle is Jeff, Juliet Echo, Foxtrot, Foxtrot.
So far we've got Len, Rob, Rich with a no, and Jeff in that order. Anyone else?
WA2EFH, Kevin.
Good evening all, this is K2KEY.
Okay, we got more than
WS2N, Paul with a no.
Good evening, Dick.
KC2MD.
Yes. Okay, Joe with a yes. Mr. MPP, did you say yes or no?
No questions tonight, Dick.
Very fine. Okay, we got more than enough to get going. Glenn, KB2QEQ. I don't think we've heard from you for quite some time. By now, you must have doubled the height of your tower, doubled the number of antennas, increased the power output of your transmitters. Give us an update, Glenn. You got it.
Oh, I wish. No, things are not going that well, but we're doing okay. Everything seems to be fine here. I got a kind of a funny question. Maybe you guys can help out. Recently picked up a wrecked vertical antenna. A friend of mine didn't want. I was taking it purely for the aluminum piping. Perhaps I could use it for something else at some time. I guess I could say what it was. It was a gap. I'm sure you know what that is. Anyway, took it home and started taking it apart just to make storage easier, what was left of it. And lo and behold, inside, there must be like 100 feet of coax cable, yellow jacketed. I never realized that was in one of those type of antennas, but it was in there. Well, maybe not 100 feet, let's say 50 feet. But I have no idea if it's anything like 50 ohm or what it is. There's no markings on it other than the manufacturer of the antenna. I'm assuming it's 50 ohm cable. Any ideas?
Yeah, I do remember Mel describing an antenna like this, which he had personal experience with. One of his neighbors, I think, put up one like that. To my knowledge, there's a full bit of coax inside of one of the vertical radiator pieces of aluminum tubing. Was a phase delay impedance matching like thing. And so I'm going to turn it over to Mel and see if that's the antenna that you described to us once before. I remember looking it up on the internet at the time and looking at the specs and the method of operation. And ultimately, I think I thought it was kind of skeptical at first, but ultimately I believe I came to the conclusion the antenna had the capability, if it was properly deployed, of doing some pretty nice performance. So tell us what you know about that particular antenna, if you remember the one we discussed a couple of months ago, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, now they got several models, Cap. Now, the one that you have, that you picked up, what kind of a counterpoint did it have on it? So I'll know which one it is, over.
That's a tough question because this thing must have been mangled up in a storm or I don't know know what, but it was really in pieces. It's just a bunch of aluminum tubing with some side pieces and stainless steel straps. I couldn't begin to tell you what model it was. The only thing I found inside one of these pieces of tubing was this yellow coaxial cable. And I just wondered whether I could use it as 50-ohm cable. I hate to throw things away, as they say. Over to you.
We're all pack rats. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, does this one have a capacitor at the top of the pipe? When you took it apart, did you find a capacitor at the top of the pipe that at the end of the coax, over?
You're absolutely right. That's affirmative. I did find a capacitor way up at the, well, it wasn't off. It's just a piece of pipe, but you're right. There was a capacitor attached to that coax. Over to you.
Okay, and it had these rods that are hanging on the end around it. That's what's called the transition rod. And this most likely sounds like it may have been the Titan model, which basically was an antenna with an elevated feed. That's why I asked if it had the capacitor at the top. That's the point of feed. And the cable zigzags in and up and down the pipe. I remember Dick and I and a few others, we discussed this. The cable itself, that yellow cable, is some kind of a specialized cable that they made up because I had questioned them, you know, about that cable, and they were very mum about two things. One, what was the capacitance value, and two, what kind of cable it was. And for some reason, they just did not want to sort of let that go. It's like something that's a trade secret with them. So I'm not sure, really, what cable. Did we determine what cable that was, Dick, when we were discussing this months ago, over?
I'm reasonably sure we did not, Mel. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. When it comes to various techniques for getting a broadband impedance match to an antenna, you're now getting pretty deep into the art and science of antenna design. And there's a large number of ways of achieving impedance match. If you go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook and you look at the section on balance and impedance matching devices, you'll see that I think there's 21 different classes of balancing devices. So from that information alone, that's not enough to tell us, was that 87.5-ohm coax cable specially made for this particular application? Len, being as conservative a guy as he is, if he wanted to, there were various techniques by which you could personally measure the impedance match of the cable. By measuring the center conductor diameter and the inner diameter of the outer conductor, and making a guess as to what is the dielectric material, is it Teflon? I doubt it. It's expensive. Is it polyethylene? Likely. Is it foam polyethylene? So with inner diameter, outer diameter, and dielectric constant, you could, with a couple of percent accuracy, determine what is the characteristic impedance of the cable. If you wanted to go one step further, I could recommend a couple of techniques by which you could electronically measure what is the characteristic impedance. A TDR is one way. Well, not very many of us have a time domain reflectometer. Another technique would be to put a 50-ohm termination at the end of the cable, and at the input end, you sweep it and measure its standing wave ratio, and so on. And if it was exactly 50-ohm cable, and you put a 50-ohm termination on the end, as you sweep the cable across any of the handbands or hop from handband to handband, you would see 50 ohms all the time. If the cable was, let's say, 70-ohm cable, and you put a 50-ohm termination, the impedance you measure would change in a cyclic manner. And with a little bit of smart coming back to the TechNet, we'd be able to identify for you what it was. If it was, say, 70-ohm cable, and you put a 70-ohm termination across the end of the cable, whatever standing wave ratio you measure would stay constant as you sweep across the band. So by various techniques, you can measure the impedance, calculate it, measure. that IP if you want to melt.
Hey, no, see if I can extend it. Something extended today, Dick. I'm curious what that other CW that was in there, 004. Anyhow, it was a nice antenna. I know we sort of broke it down, you know, systematically and how it works and what it does. And rather than destroy it, you could possibly, you know, restore it. It's an expensive antenna. It's a very expensive vertical antenna. And it works. As far as my friend is concerned, he's very satisfied with it. It works extremely well. And as they say, it has a small footprint. So, you know, getting mangled, but most of the time, the only thing that gets mangled I see on those antennas is those transition rods that hang off of it. It takes a beating, but the pipes, the vertical pipes, don't seem to be pretty sturdy. So I would assume, with a little ingenuity, as they say, you could restore this antenna, put it back together, and maybe you need a vertical or one that can be, you know, transported easily, like a field day or whatever. You have a very nice working multi-band antenna, Dick, over.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. I vaguely remember, Mel, you and I concluded that this was of the class of antennas where the radiator section was electronically a half wave. And making the radiator section electronically a half wave instead of quarter wave has significant advantages as far as the number of ground plane radials that are no longer required, and that the center of radiation is higher up in the air, and so on. So, do consider, as I see it, Len, the possibility of reconstructing the missing components and putting it back together the way it was, since it's such an expensive antenna with reasonably high performance according to everything that we can ascertain. So back to you, Len. KB2 QEQ. And by the way, come back in future weeks and let us know what you decided. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. Two avenues to go here. I'm going to try the SWR beta test just for laughs and see what shows up. Interested in trying that. And I may just get in touch with the company and explain to them that I have this wreck. And probably is a Titan, and maybe they can send me some paperwork and I can determine what's missing and what I need, and it may just pay for me to fix it up, as you say. Again, gentlemen, I'm going to thank you. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice, so I'm going to have to jump off here. I say thanks again at 73, and I'm going to stand by and monitor. Take care. WB2QEQ sign.
Following you. Good luck with that project, Len. Okay, Rob was the next person, I think. If I can read my writing, WB2OMW, is it, Rob? Go right ahead, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
NWXQN, I have the website for a gap and the...
Okay, Paul's got the website and the phone number. Why don't you give us that information first, Paul? Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll probably look it up anyway, but GAP antenna, GAPANTENNA.com, and the phone number that they give is 772-571-9922.
772-571-9972, and GAPANTENNA.com, if I got you correctly. Did I have that correct, Paul?
Yes, GAPANTENNA.com. So, page 138 on the QSC. These are QSC, August of this year. They have a picture of the Titan, anyway. So, very good. Thank you.
Page 138. Sounds good, Paul. Thank you. Okay, Rob, WB2OMW, I think it is. Correct me if I'm wrong. K2RIW, you got it, Rob.
Challenge your mom. Thank you, Nick, and good evening, all. Recently, the last storm took out my Carolina Wyndham wire antenna, and now I'm agonizing over what type of antenna to put back, because I'm not sure if the tree is going to last another few years. Having looked at all the specifications of jamming, as the case may be. I'm not an avid DXer just yet, but what antenna would you recommend putting back? Beam, vertical, or both?
Yeah, not an easy decision. Various kinds of wire antennas give you an awful lot of performance for the money. Whether it be a vertically polarized wire antenna, a very rare item, but it should be strongly considered. If you've got a single tree or tower or any other kind of support structure tall enough for a half wavelength. Half wavelength vertical polarized dipole, which does not have to be fed in the center. You can feed it from the bottom as a J-pole or as a loaded coil or whatever. A zillion ways you can do it. Requires almost no ground plane radials at all. And that antenna you wouldn't see that I just described, you wouldn't see it described in any of the antenna books for reasons that are very mysterious to Mel and I. Horizontal dipoles, fan dipoles, they do very well. The Wyndham is a class of off-center fed dipole. Even though they're not popular, there's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. You can feed it 5% in the center, 5%, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50% off to one side. The choice is yours. If you've got the right kind of a balancing device, and recognize the fact that the drive impedance becomes higher and higher in ohms as you feed it off to one side. Now, the whole idea of the Carolina Wyndham is not only does the impedance go up as you feed it off to one side, but it has certain harmonic relationships where you get more than one band at the same time. And would you rather get more than one band in the Carolina approach as opposed to the fan dipole?
To read it, transmit.
As opposed to a fan dipole approach, that choice is yours. When you make the dedication to go beam on HF frequencies, 40, 20, 15, and 10, and on all the walk bands in between, that's a reasonably big jump in hardware requirement. To properly mount a beam high enough up to give you the performance you'd like to have with a rotator, so you can take advantage of the fact that it's a directional antenna, that is, let me pick a number, 10 times higher in price compared to wire antennas. A lot more resources. You get more for your money. You get more performance. You get more for your money, and that's a tough one. So, as you can tell, I'm not a strict HFer. I've used HF a little bit. I'm primarily a VHFer. Mel and his merry group of guys at the Kings County Radio Club have dwelled a lot more in HF, and I bet you he's got a couple of recommendations for your particular question. K2KEY, what do you think Rob should put up? K2RIW.
WB2HWW, would you want to comment on that stick, please?
I would recognize, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Say good evening to Howard. I spoke to you a little bit of time. Hope all is well. Well, I could say it's the model book, with your location. No doubt that I think says that. In station, and of course, and a number of beams will work quite well, as I have learned over the years and experienced with comparison to my tower of the yard with the beams up there, the HF, compared to a lot of the vertical dipoles. I'm sure run the gamut of every kind of configuration. No doubt went through 100 different antennas. Of course, for the low frequencies such as 160, 80, 40, the best thing is, I think, would most likely agree, would be some kind of a dipole configuration or a vertical configuration. You know, that's getting into the beams, Yagi's on those frequencies is quite a massive job, quite expensive, need a lot of real estate. So, I don't know if I'm sure that you wouldn't even be considering that, but if you're going to do just general work on, say, between 10 and 20 meters of band, I would say to you, look into something like a vertical, works quite well, and there's several verticals around that are excellent, and other than that, as Dick says, you can't go wrong with a dipole, and I've found that many a time it works extremely well. And for most general amateur radio communications, It's a good bang for the buck. Back to you, Tim.
Yeah, I see that Rob lives in Levittown, and I've got a guess that a high percentage of the pieces of property in Levittown are a lot smaller than an acre. So without having a whole lot of real estate, putting up a good-sized tower and a rotary beam is a bit on the difficult side. If you've got a real good relationship with your neighbors, you can probably do that. But you got to be careful with those kind of things. The nice thing about wire antennas, Rob, is that we amateurs, we go around, we look up in the air, and we see wire, and it shows up immediately in our brain. And the wire that is part of LIPO or loco wiring or Con Ed wiring, we don't see that. And the utility poles, we don't see that. But on top of people's houses and the trees around it, that wire, we see it immediately because we're looking for it. The general population absolutely positively doesn't see wire. Mel will tell you that you can fill up your backyard with sand dipoles that favor east-west and sand dipoles that favor north-south and sand dipoles that are high and low and vertical wire. You can fill up your backyard with wire. Unless you make it day glow red and aim searchlights out at nighttime, your neighbors will not see it and the people who visit you will not see it. People do not look up in the air. If you want to make a check of that, but of all the people that visit you, after they're inside of your house, ask them what are the color of the shingles that are on your house. And I guarantee they won't be able to answer that question. Because they're busy looking at the walk they're walking on as they come up your driveway, and they don't look up in the air. So wire allows you to get away with an awful lot of murder. And wire antennas, properly set up, can do a lot. Consider the possibility of a wire beam. In other words, if you've got the right kind of supports around, where you can set up these catenary of wires on the left and right side, and in between, you string the actual elements of the beam out of wire and egg insulators. There's a couple of designs like that. It's a kind of antenna that's not easy to change the direction, but if it's a particular favorite direction, you've got a guy you want to talk to in South Africa or in London, and you know the direction to aim it, and you set up a wire beam, that will give you a tremendous amount of performance with very few dollars of raw materials. So there's 5,000 kinds of antennas. I'm not kidding, Rob. I mean, lots of people think you bend a wire and a coat hanger or a paperclip in various ways, and you get an antenna. Huh? There's 5,000 kinds of antennas. Choosing the best one for you, even if you chose the best solution today, 6 months from now, you might want to go try another one. That's where we really shine. We tinker a repeater.
Time out.
All of us that are serious, we tinker a lot with antennas because we don't build rigs anymore. When Dell and I cut our teeth on ham radio in the early 50s, every respected ham radio operator built his own transmitter and built his own receiver. And those few guys that could afford the store-bought and stuff, we call those appliance operators, if you know what I mean. Well, the world has turned upside down. Rigs have gotten so complicated. For a week's salary, you could buy a rig that would take you 2 years to build. You don't want to build a rig anymore. But when it comes to the antenna, no matter what antenna you select, it may not be the final decision. Keep on asking people what they're using, what the performance they're getting out of it, what did it cost, how difficult is it to put up. Read the books, read the articles, come on to the TechNet as often as you want. Ask antenna questions. That's our favorite question, as you can tell, Rob, from Mel and I. So I know we haven't given you an exact answer. We've tried to give you a little bit of the raw ingredients as to how you can help make that decision. And you don't have to make the decision immediately. WB2OMW, come on back and ask the question as many times as you like, Rob. K2RIW. Oh, stand by. Howie did have a comment on this subject. Howie, if you were in Rob's shoes, what would you?
Repeat. RXE.
What would you put up as a rock crusher antenna, Howie? Go ahead, Howie.
Well, a couple of the guys on my repeater system have bought these PAR antennas, these halfway dipoles, and fed, and they're working very good. Dick, just a few other comments. The other thing is, if you have a chance, I'd like to make a comment on some audio stuff that was discussed last week about repeater fetching. It's an area of my interest, and if I can, if you can fit me in within the next half hour, I'd like to spend about 2 minutes or 5 minutes discussing Peter's fashion, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. But as far as the antenna is concerned, I think that a lot of guys use it as PAR antenna. There's one guy, W2GOD, his name is Steve, and he's having a lot of good luck with it. So a lot of guys using these internet dipole in their apartment is working very well. Back to you, Dick.
WV2. Okay, HWW. Very fine, Howie. Thank you for that information. So, Rob, back to you. We didn't give you an exact answer. It's not an easy question. It almost falls in the category of would I be happier if I married a blonde or a brunette? Well, in both the marriage situation and choosing the ideal antenna in your backyard, there's a lot more variables involved than first meets the eye, but I guarantee the antenna is a lot easier than choosing a wife. You got it, Rob.
Thank you, Wyo.
Wyo recognized, but Rob first. Go ahead, Rob.
WV2OMW. Well, I'm going to stay away from the blonde brunette question. That's a discussion for another time. Anyway, you've actually given me some good ideas, as well as another question. I may actually go back with another Carolina Wyndham. I did get permission from my neighbor to use his tree, which is towards the middle of his yard, and the tree in front of my house is the other end. And I've worked Australia and Eastern Europe and stuff in between. So it did work quite well. The other question, I hope it's a short kind of answer that I have, is from Mel with regards to verticals. You mentioned 10 to 20 meter vertical would work quite nicely. I've seen advertised verticals that cover 10 through 80 with a coil for 80. Mel, what do you think of those?
I have never used one, really, personally. Like I say, I only have had experience with other amateurs that have been somewhat happy with their antennas, such as the gap antenna type that we were talking about previously a little while ago. They're a little pricey, that's the point. And really worth that kind of investment. However, there's a lot of people that step by already and hold the opportunity. Now he runs vertical. Rich, are you on frequency? Can you make a comment about your vertical? Over.
Yeah, no, I'm not satisfied now on an HD. Just email for me. I think the touchdown R is the top that is tested for the wonderful.
Okay, I did get that. I believe you said Chris Craft R8.
I'm sure it's a very good antenna. I've had one now for about 5 years. It's about 7 feet high. Does not require radio or 7 foot monopoly or
okay, the main thing that he was saying very noisily is that that particular antenna doesn't require a ground plane radio. Any of the antennas in the vertical class where the radiator itself is an electronic half wave, if you're feeding it at the bottom, you're feeding something like 1,000 ohm impedance instead of a 70 ohm impedance. At first, it sounds like a disadvantage. It's a huge advantage if you're smart enough to come up with some kind of a very simple step-up impedance device like a J-pole or a loaded coil, and there's many other techniques for doing it. And because that impedance at the bottom is so high, you can get away with either almost none or just one single ground plane radio or one ground rod in the ground. And the antenna itself is a balanced structure within. It's got the upper half quarter wave radiator and the lower half quarter wave radiator all built into it. In the case of a true quarter wave ground plane vertical antenna, you're trying to emulate the other half of the dipole, so to speak, by making a mirror image in the ground, by making the ground look like a great big sheet of copper, and to do it well with high efficiency requires 32 ground plane radials. The manufacturer of your particular antenna will tell you only 2 or 4 radials are required. He's afraid to tell you that you have to have all those other radios if you want high performance, for fear that you wouldn't buy his brand name. And if you don't, and because the average amateur can measure standing wave ratio, but we cannot measure radiation. have enough ground plane radios on your quarter wave antenna, and if two-thirds of your power is heating up the dirt in your backyard and making the worms warm and happy in the wintertime, you do not know that. And if you care enough, it should bother you a little bit. So quarter wave antennas require lots of ground plane radios. Half wave antennas require less and less, almost none. And if you put it up at a high enough altitude, essentially none at all. So there's a whole class of antennas along those lines. Simple wire antenna, halfway vertical dipole, can give you an awful lot of bang for the money. But so can a horizontal. Strung up in the trees with a slingshot and a monofilament fishing line to haul up the rope, which hauls up the antenna. Make it a band dipole. If you want multiple frequencies, make it a dipole with a whole bunch of loading coils. Lots and lots of ways to go. Maybe Bernie wants to add a couple of words on this. KQYO, go right ahead if you do, Bernie. And if not, repeater.
Time out.
If you want me to add you to the list of Bernie, of the couple of guys that are ahead of you, I'll do that also. KQYO, KQLIW. You got it, Bernie.
WB2HWW.
Howie recognized after Bernie. Go ahead, Bernie.
Actually, my comment was for a fill from Howie. You mentioned the par, I believe you said par antenna. Can you give us the spelling on that? The par, like in golf, P-A-R electronics. The other comment was just recently in QES, I believe it was the last issue, I wouldn't swear to it. An interesting article where they did some testing about how many ground plane radials, how many ground plane radials actually make a difference on a vertical antenna. If anybody's interested, I'll bring up what issue that was, but it was one of the last two issues, I think. So any question is for how many, what's the name of the antenna manufacturer for the NSTED HF antenna?
Yeah, I do remember the article that was in QEX, and the bottom line I'm reasonably sure is going to be, if it's a quarter wave ground plane radio mounted at ground level and you want high performance, the number of ground plane radios is a big number, like 30. And there's a law of diminishing returns in there somewhere. But all of those 30 ground plane radios, which for a small piece of property, possibly in Levittown, is not an easy thing to do, consider some of these other alternative antennas, in my opinion. Okay, for that PAR question, go right ahead, Howie. You got it, Howie.
Let me see if W2GLD is out there. He's the one in all that antenna. You out there, Steve? If not, let me just put it in place. PAR Electronics, they're in QST. Their antennas are not that expensive. They are portable antennas. They can be carried in your back pocket. They have a little box at the end with a connector on it. One of the guys on this repeater is using the antennas with no problem, Dick. He's making contacts on 20 meters. He's got one for 10, one for 20, and make one for each band. Dick, can you put me into a rotation? If I'm possible, last week, Richie had an interesting question about impedance matching, and I'd like to give some thoughts on it because that's my area of interest is audio design. So if you can, I'd like to make a comment on impedance matching and get your comment on it, too. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Very fine, Howie. You're on the list, and that's a subject I've had a lot of interest in also, particularly when combined with operational amplifiers. And I just discovered the real good book on the subject, a couple of real good books. Okay, we're going to move on to the try to get through the list at some reasonable length of time so we don't keep people up real late. The next person was Jeff, W-A-2-R-A-S. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Jeff. H-U-R-A-W, my name is Dick.
Oh, okay, Dick. W-A-2-R-A-S here. My situation is that shortly after I got back on the air, about 2 years ago, I've been off the air since about 1965, I noticed a problem in that when I went on the air, I would, you've heard of TVI, I had sprinkler interference. My lawn sprinkler would turn on, if I had the thing set for an hour and a half or 2 hours, it would water the lawn for 2 hours. And I solved the problem with an AC line filter. Fast forward to today. For a while, I've been first my wife mentioned some sort of a banging noise, and I noticed it. Usually I have headphones on, but I didn't today. And every time I hit a voice peak, I was on 80 meter AM, you know, I heard a terrible banging sound. I had someone operate the rig. I went outside, and I not only heard the banging, which seemed to be coming from inside the house, but I heard a squishing sound. And what was happening was the sprinkler system was being activated on voice peaks. In other words, as you talk, the heads of the sprinklers were popping up, and the banging that I was hearing was also coming on voice peaks. Those were apparently water pipes inside the house that knocked together when the sprinklers turned on, and it was constantly going on and off as you're talking. So this is a problem. A couple of suggestions have come up already. What do you think about this one, Dick? Back to Net.
Yeah, once you're on HF frequencies, the wiring of your house becomes a convenient antenna in certain circumstances. Some piece of the wire in your house happens to have a resonant lens picking up a signal. That signal in turn is getting into the control circuitry for your sprinkler system and turning it on in various ways. There's lots of ways you can bypass electronically shield RF the wiring that goes into your sprinkler system. And so that's going to be required. The sprinkler system probably has, maybe it's got 24-volt control circuitry, maybe it's got 110-volt input to a power supply, and by various techniques with buying filters, which you put on one in the past, but you're going to need a more stoochy one now, I can tell. Moving the antenna so that it doesn't excite the wiring is one possible approach. Consider that. But ways of bypassing it with disc ceramic capacitors, ferrite devices that clamp around the wire. There's a whole bunch of ways of doing it. It's going to take a little bit of experimenting. When you open up the actual plastic package of the control circuitry for your sprinkler system, I'm sure you're going to be mildly horrified to find that it's a simple printed circuit board with essentially no RF bypassing. In other words, the manufacturer, for reasons of cost savings, didn't bother putting in one simple ceramic bypass capacitor to make sure the RF doesn't get into the delicate circuitry that makes the yes-no decision. And as far as your actual valve being turned on and off, yeah, there's ways of putting a piston-like device in the pipe so that you don't get pipes banging together. That was on this old house a couple of months ago. But for the pipes to bang together once, when the sprinkler system turns on, once per day, that's not a real big problem. I wouldn't worry about that one. But you certainly don't want them turning on and off like that cyclically. And so you're going to have to stop that at the source to stop the RF energy from getting into that control circuitry. There probably are a number of other people on frequency who have got some opinions and maybe suggestions on this subject. Please give me a call. Let us right now on sprinkler interference from RF circuitry, KQRIW, listening.
KC2DEP, what a different interference issue.
Okay, KC2DEP recognized, but does anyone have a suggestion for improvement of Jeff's situation? That's what I'm looking for right now. Go ahead.
K2KEY.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Had similar experiences with different control devices around the house. And what I found, I could say, is you take one of those little control devices, it's really bare bones electronics. Cheap is a fancy word for it. I would use another word. However, I took the device, I just wrapped it in aluminum foil. That's all I did, wrapped it in aluminum foil and grounded the aluminum foil to the conduit, and seems like it works miracles, Dick. I believe the RF just goes right through the goddamn plastic case, and that's where the problem is, seems to me. It's sensitive, very sensitive, when it's completely unshielded, but put some kind of shielding on, just bare bone shielding, and it seems to make a world of difference, Dick, over.
But biasing the transistor.
That would be making a change in the design. I'm not recommending that one, Howie. Hey, Mel, I'd like to suggest if wrapped it around the control box and extended that a little bit and wrapped it around the wiring going into the control box a few inches down that wire. Very simple experiment to find that shielding will do it. And if that is successful, and I give you a better than 60% chance it will be successful, your next step will be, because there's a control panel and I want to see it, and I can't see it with the tinfoil on there, what do I do next? And from then on, finding the right kind of screening that you put on the front end of the tinfoil so you can look through the screening and look at the liquid crystal display, if there is one, or be able to push the button, so to speak, and still have the RF shielding by the screening joining the tinfoil in some kind of way. There's various ways you can do that. So, looks to me like you've got a significant number of possible solutions. We're going to give you a little bit of a homework assignment here, Jeff, to try the tinfoil approach. And if that's successful, you're home free with a rather simple solution as I see it. W2RAS with a little bit of delay in case someone's got a great solution they want to tell you about. T2RAW in the TechNet. You've got it, Jeff.
Okay, I hope you can hear me over the ID. First of all, that's a spectacular idea, I think, and I definitely will try it. But just let me throw this out to you, because this suggestion came up earlier today from another member of the club who's actually not on. Now I'm not sure who suggested it, but anyway, somebody suggested it today, which was I was Hal K6CPZ. Now I remember, which is unplug, just pull the AC, transformer out of the adapter, out of the wall when you're on the air, so it's not connected to the. To the AC line, or use some sort of a timer, since the sprinkler I sprinkle between 4 and 6 a.m. Have the sprinkler but by use of a timer not operating, not connected except between 4 and 6 a.m. and presumably there's a backup battery holding the memory of the system. And the other possibility, and this is getting a little bit more difficult than what you just suggested, which is a toroid over the AC line cord. What do you think about those ideas, Dave?
Yeah, Radio Shack will sell you a chunk of ferrite that comes apart in two pieces, and it's got a plastic outer white case that clips, and you can put the power cord through it. I give that a 50-50 chance. They sell various kinds of toroids where you can wind the power cord through it. Hal's approach is a beautiful brute force approach. Remove all raw power going into it so the circuit is thoroughly disabled when you're on the air. However, the day is going to happen, where there's going to be a fantastic band opening, and you're going to want to talk to that rare South Sea island at 6 o'clock in the morning when the sprinkler is running. So that one's a little bit on the severe side, but let's hope the tinfoil works. Unplugging it, of course, will work. Putting another timer on it, of course, will work, as long as you're not operational during its active time. And so it looks to me like you've got a lot of solutions, but solving the problem at the source, finding out how is the RF getting in there in the first place and stopping it, with a little bit of a learning curve, that one's not as difficult as you think. Just by looking at that printed circuit board and saying, gee, if I put a 001 disc ceramic capacitor right here, acting as an RF bypass to the grounded lead of the printed circuit board, there's an 80% chance that would solve it by adding a 50-cent part out of the bubble pack for Radio Shack, if you know what I mean, by a bunch of 001 disc ceramic capacitors with 100-volt ratings. Make it 200-volt ratings to be on the safe side, just in case. Well, wait a minute now. The wall wart is bringing the whole circuit down to something like 12 or 15 volts, so that's not as much of a problem as you think. So you don't even have to worry about the voltage rating of the disc ceramic capacitors. You've got quite a number of solutions, as I see it, that Jeff. Please pick in those at the top, make colors. finally settled on. Thank you, Jeff, for any finals. K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, K2LIW, W-A-2-R-E-S. The final thought is I was talking to Andy, W-A-2-C-D-L, earlier, and he was the one who suggested first, seconded by Rich, that I check into the net with this situation that just came to a head today. Anyway, CDL, his suspicion is that it's not going through the AC line. He was asking me questions about the proximity of where the dipole, it's an 80-meter dipole of sorts, is being fed, and how close the feed point is to the control box of the sprinkler system. And the answer is it's only about 20 feet away. Needless to say, or maybe not needless, it only happens under high power. It takes more than 150 watts of RF output, which is why it's happening on voice speaks. So anyway, that's my final thing, that maybe it's not the ACE coming through the AC line, but it's actually picking up RF coming back down the coax. On that note, I appreciate all the suggestions. K2LAW and then WA2RAS.
KC2, QRQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, this is just something I'd like to throw out there, because I've seen similar problems like this with telephones, alarm systems, and other things. I have a couple of questions. One is, what band does this happen on? Because these kinds of issues, usually there's one band that aggravates it, and you said higher power level. Around what power level do you notice this problem at? KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, he just told us that on 80 meters, when he runs more than 150 watts. How about you, Glenn?
Yeah, okay, usually 80-meter issues, the easiest way to get rid of those are grounding the transmitter. My next question is, do you have a ground rod somewhere very, very close to the transmitter where you go a nice 10-footer, you can put right into the ground coming shortly right between your amplifier. In other words, basically you have your radio grounded to your amplifier, to your antenna tuner, and right from there you need a very, very large ground rod going into the ground near from the shack, relatively short wire. Do you have that in your station?
Okay, now here we're getting into a slightly controversial area. Glenn and I don't 100% agree on this one. If you're not using a balancing device right at the center of the 80-meter dipole, by definition, there is a significant amount of RF energy flowing back down on the outside shield of the coax cable. It's not a drastic situation, but it's less than ideal. It means that the feed line is doing some of the radiating as well as the antenna, and the both advantages and disadvantages of that. The advantages, you got a more complicated wave being sent out there in more directions of space, so there's a little higher probability you're going to pick somebody up in some crazy direction where the dipole would normally have a null. That's the good news. The bad news, RF energy flowing down the cable can give you a hot microphone where your D104 bites you in the lip when you talk into it, and the cable being a radiator coming into the house is now going near the house wiring with RF energy on it, possibly increasing your television interference, increasing the interference to other appliances in the house. And Glenn's suggestion of putting down a ground rod, without a doubt, would help. In other words, now not as much RF energy can appear at the shack end of the cable because of it being well grounded. But that's attacking the symptom, not attacking the cause, from my point of view. That's where Glenn and I differ a little bit. We're both right. You just decide who you want to listen to, if you know what I mean. So I would prefer the balancing approach of the coax cable itself runs cold, and that can cure a number of crazy conditions in the house. So you've got a few things to try as I see it here, Jeff. Balancing, if you want to add one, a Unideller or W2AD. There's a whole bunch of these balancing devices, and be careful a little bit with those because some of them have a power rating. If you buy one that's only good for 100 watts and you put a gallon through it, that can give you some grief also. And the Chick-fil-A approach, I'd like to hear which of those experiments you try and which ones give you the improvement, and please come back with suggestions on that. KC2DEP told told us he had a similar kind of interference. Why don't you give us a quick description on your interference? Start off with your name, sir. DEP-KQLIW-RIW.
Not again, Dick-KQLIW-RIW.
No recognized. DEP first, go ahead.
All right, give him Dick. Name is Charlie. Kilo Charlie, do Delta Echo Papa. Yeah, I didn't catch the name of the gentleman with the sprinkler issue, but I was running into a problem with that. Don't remember the exact band I was on, but I believe it was 20 and 40 meters. My CO detector's in the house. Every time I key up, there is some delay between my transmissions and the alarm sounding on the CO detectors. Did the same thing, wrapped in foil. This unit also ran on battery, and it has an AC transformer on it. Did trial and error, wrapped it in foil, pulled the battery out, ran it on battery, ran it off AC, every which way. I even clipped the transformer, figured that was an antenna. Had no luck with that, and then scratched my head one day, and I noticed my antenna was not properly angled. I have a Cushstrength R8, and found that there was a mechanical issue with the antenna. And needless to say, my RF was not really going out of the antenna, which is working its way back back down the coax and started interfering with my CO detectors. But, just another crazy thing to look at. As indicated, I did try the foil. Aluminum foil had stood up one leg, had no luck. But, you could be running into different circumstances.
Charlie, to interfere with a safety device like a CO detector scares me a little bit. What do you believe was the final solution to make sure that your CO detectors were not giving you a false alarm from RF energy? Thank you, Charlie.
Well, one thing, because I have three of the same units in the house, basically what I was affecting was the display circuitry, and it wasn't actually the alarming portion. I was basically telling the display that, okay, I was giving 600 parts per million, and there is a specific exposure level that the unit will go into alarm. I did verify. I'm a captain in the fire department in the Rockville Center, so I did verify. Did a little troubleshooting in that sense, but I was able to verify that the CO detectors are in working order. But like I said, it's just no matter what I've done, I did the aluminum foil, grounded it to the outlet. I even clipped the transformer as indicated. Eliminate a little antenna there, but still had no luck. And as indicated, I took my punches, walked away, and then happened to notice my antenna outside, and found a mechanical issue with the antenna. So like I said, it really wasn't a perfect radiator. Everything's just bleeding back into the CO unit. KC2DB.
Okay, now to repeat what I think I just heard, once you fix the mechanical issue with the antenna, so that RF energy was not flowing back down the coax, did the CO indicators after that no longer have changes in their display? Did the problem get cured when you fixed the mechanical problem of your antenna? Back to you, Charlie.
Yep. Let's see. I'd taken the antenna down about 3 years ago and put it up 4th of July weekend. Just a quick synopsis of what happened. The lower portion of the antenna is a double bubble aluminum top. And what happened was the top portion of the antenna, just the wear and tear, wound up the outer sleeve, wound up breaking, sent a bunch of pictures to Cushcraft. Yes, the antenna was 4.5 years old. They determined it was metal fatigue, and they sent me a new lower section. Put the antenna back up. Crossed my fingers and the CQ till I was blue in the face and none of the CO detectors started screaming at me.
Good time. So, a mechanical failure of the antenna or improper use or the lack of use of a balancing device, any of the things that can make your coaxial cable, outer shield, RF hot, it's called the common mode transmission problem. In other words, you're supposed to be using the coax cable in the differential mode. You're expressing a voltage between the semiconductor and the shield on the inside, and you'd rather not have RF energy flowing down the outside. So, for a bunch of reasons, try to avoid having RF energy flow down the outside of the coax cable, because it will increase television interference, telephone interference, phone antenna, and it's supposed to all stay there. If the energy, because of an impedance mismatch of the antenna, reflects back down the cable on the inside of the cable, that's perfectly okay. But if it's some kind of a transition taking place at the antenna, the RF energy is now flowing down the outside of the coax cable. In general, that's undesirable. And there's a reasonably high chance it's going to give you some grief. Mel got some suggestions on all of this. K2KEY, K2LIW, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, let me put it to you this way. I've had a number of people that have asked me, talked to me, and discussed complaints. Now, complaints that I have had, or problems I've had, was with like 20 meters running, you know, the full power on 20 meters, and having things like the sprinkler system go haywire, having the pool control system really gave me a headache. That is what switches the solar panels on for the pool, for the heating of the pool. It channels the water through the solar panel starting at around 7 o'clock in the morning, 6:30 in the morning. And that was when bonkers. Shielding the control boxes on those devices on 20 meters was took care of it. However, I hear complaints more about 80 meters. This was the funny part. 80 meters seems to be more prevalent complaints that I've been hearing. And one of the so-called simplest answers I've given to them, you mentioned putting balums up on there, on the system and all, I have suggested to a number of people, use open wire, 450 or 600 ohm open wire feeders. And I'll tell you, Dick, going to the balanced tuner, balanced input of the tuner, using open wire feeders seems to be the most elegant way that to do that. For one reason or another, it seems to lick a heck of a lot of problems on 80 meters, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I'm certainly going to agree with that. A well-installed dipole antenna on, say, for instance, 80 meters is a thoroughly balanced structure. And if you feed it with a balanced transmission line, 300, 450, 600 ohm, open wire line, a balanced transmission line, then in theory it becomes very easy to make the wire used, the transmission line used in the differential mode, which is the good mode, the well-shielded mode. Differential mode means that at one instant of time, you're applying plus 100 volts to the right-hand side and minus 100 volts to the left-hand wire. On the other half cycle, you're reversing that. But when you're using them thoroughly in the differential mode, the cable is the world's best shielded device. Even though your eye says, hey, that's an open piece of wire, it should radiate like a benching. Uh-huh. It radiates not one iota if you use it in the balanced mode. That's the brute force, elegant Cadillac approach. If the next approach is if you're a person who's in love with coax cable, and a lot of us are, nothing wrong with that. As long as you buy the right kind of a balancing device, right at the upper end of the coax cable where it joins the antenna, then again you stop any RF energy from flowing down the outside of the cable. However, when you get to a band as low as 80 meters, to get a balun big enough ferrite or toroids inside of that great big white device, so that it can tolerate a frequency as low as 80 meters and a power as high as a kilowatt, with a maybe your antenna's got a VISWR of 2 to 1. That combination, the balun has to work harder as you go to a lower frequency. The balun has to work harder as you go to higher power. The balun has to work harder as you go to higher standing wave ratio of the antenna. So to buy a balun that's big enough to do the job correctly at 80 meters, that represents a little bit of care of the purchase. Just don't go walk into a flea market and buy a $2 item and pray that that's going to do it. It might not. And another approach is you could make yourself a halfway coaxial balun structure. Well, at 80 meters, that's a lot of cable. You don't really want to do that. So the right balancing device or open wire feed, these are the better approaches. But any RF energy flowing down the outside of the cable and grounding things in the shack to stop it can work, but you're attacking the symptom, not the cause. I would rather attack the problem right at the root of the problem, the cause. And that is, in many cases, a hot transmission line is the cause. Or the antenna itself being super close to the white repeater.
Time out.
The antenna itself being super close to the wiring of the house. There's also something magic about 80 meters where the wiring of a house more easily runs into resonance of some kind. Just a lot of people have had experience. has on one. So, all right, Jim, good luck with that project, and hope that'll work well. I think Kevin was the next person on the list. I think Kevin said yes, but I may be wrong on that one. W-A-2 Echo Fox Juliet. Kevin, go right ahead if you do have a question. K2LIW in the deck mask. Okay, maybe Kevin did not. Maybe one of the pre-tumor. Joe was the next guy on our list. W-A-2RYY, one of our frequent sign-ins. What you've been doing these days, Joe. And be careful with all that RF you radiate. I put my hand up in the air and I feel it. That was a joke. W-A-2RYY, K2LIW.
Under a kilowatt, so there's no problem, Nick.
Understand. Go right ahead with your question and comment, Joe.
Okay, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this question properly. I just let it out to you and see what happens. Is it possible to have a leak develop, an RF leak develop from a source, and have the leak actually be more and less apparent at certain frequencies in the band?
Absolutely. I can think of various leaking devices. I say, for instance, I've got a coax connector on the back end of my signal generator. And the coax connector is held down with aluminum rivets into a copper chassis. I've got dissimilar metals. Some oxide builds up, and now it's making a flaky contact. So now the coaxial connector in my Siri example is not well ground to the chassis, and therefore RF energy is being put onto the so-called grounded portion of a UG21, which is a type N chassis mount connector, for instance. And now it's making the cable hot. Okay. I'm launching some RF energy in the cable right at the signal generator, which maybe is a signal generator, maybe it's a transmitter. And now, you guys have heard me say it a zillion times. When you want to make efficient radiation, you resonate first, then you radiate. That transmission line that you are now launching an RF energy into, it has a certain length and it's going to some other object, like an antenna or another amplifier or whatever. As you sweep the frequency region, there's frequency range, there's going to be some range where that length of coax cable that you're making hot is now some integral number of wavelengths that are resonant, a quarter wave into a short circuit, a quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave. There are some individual frequencies where that length of cable is resonant. So I can launch the exact same number of volts onto that cable, but at certain frequencies, it'll radiate a hell of a lot better than other frequencies. So the word shielding is a relative word. What am I launching the undesired signal into? What is its electrical characteristics versus frequency? I could launch a signal into a cable, and I would think there's no radiation going on because some other piece of electronics is not affected at all at that frequency. Go to a slightly different frequency. Either my electronics is more susceptible or my cable is a better radiator at that frequency. So, without a doubt, leakage could be frequency sensitive. Now, if the leakage happens to be a simple round hole in the side of the cabinet, that's not so frequency sensitive. But in my particular example, there's a zillion more like it. You can see how it could very well be frequency sensitive, in my opinion, Joe. To me, 2RYY, K2RIW.
Now that you know that, now I'll give you some details so you can digest this. I took my outside antenna and pointed it north. It was actually from about north-northeastern, 0-30 degrees, to see if I could pick up stuff from Connecticut. It worked fairly well in the digital mode, and I decided to try and see if I could scan the channels and find out if there were any analog channels still on the air from that direction, and if I could... Okay, so I had the antenna pointed in this particular direction. I'm picking up one particular channel, and I initially did not realize what it was. I picked up another channel, a little higher than that, a channel 19, and these channels didn't identify, which normally an over-the-air channel would identify once, at least once every hour, something like that. So it made me think that I'm possibly picking up a cable leak. I looked elsewhere in the band, and I could see other channels that are coming in much, much weaker. Than these two channels, but they had to be channels 14, actually coming, channels that became cable channel 66 and cable channel 70. When it went lower in the band, taking the TV, putting the cable mode, so it would scan cable, cheap TV channels, but over the air antenna, I could pick up channels 24, 25, 26, but they were much, much weaker in level. than when I was viewing up on the UHF end of the band. That's why I asked the question about frequency, differential frequency, the difference in frequency make a more of a difference in radiated energy coming from a particular point where it was coming from. That's what I'm basing this whole thing on.
Oh, you've got a good one there, Joe. When it comes to leakage from a cable TV system, and right now you've got a significant amount of evidence that possibly what you're experiencing, the leakage from the cable system, for a bunch of reasons, you will not get a constant signal strength. Each of the individual channels in the cable themselves may be fairly constant. A well-balanced cable system takes zillions of channels there and tries to adjust each one of them to be the same dBmV, dB over a millivolt. They try to make them all the same amplitude, because one that really dominates would be making the third order intermodulation distortion on the others. So you have a balanced system. However, if they've got a poorly installed connector, or if the neighbor, nowadays, because of the CLI, Cumulative Leakage Index requirement for a cable TV system, because cable TV tends to reuse the exact same frequencies that are used by the FAA for aircraft control and communication. As such, there is a strong demand that the FAA makes on a local cable TV system that you will have a well-shielded system, so that when my airplane flies over your town, over your cable TV system, it doesn't get jammed, if you know what I mean. I want to be able to communicate because lives are involved here. So there's some very strong requirements on that. However, even though the cable TV system may be meeting that requirement, in the near range where you've got a neighbor right across the street, and maybe that neighbor has got the drop cable coming into his house from the cable TV system, and he decides to distribute it to five different televisions in the house, and he decides to do it without a proper power dividing shielded device with type F connectors on it. He decides to do it with, let me drop, some kind of a makeshift wiring where he's run twin lead with thumbtacks under the rug for the various rooms to power the TV set, for instance. Or he's got a piece of cable on the back of one of the television sets where, because the wife has to pull the set away from the wall every week when she vacuums behind there, she's pulling on that cable, and eventually the shield broke away. Because the cable TV company gives you a signal that is so strong, you could possibly have a broken shield on the back of the TV set, which is lowering the signal strength getting to the TV by 20 decibels. The automatic gain controls of the set overtakes that. You get a reasonably snow-free picture, you're happy, and you never know what's going on. And now all of that wiring of that cabling in the house is radiating that cable TV system. However, when the cable TV common mode signal on the outside of the wiring in that house is radiating, it will be very frequency sensitive. If you had some kind of a small Yagi antenna on a portable television set, and you walked around that person's house, and you tuned to each one of those channels one at a time, you would find various locations in their yard would give you a strong signal, and you move a few feet over to one side, and you get a weak signal, because you're getting partial cancellation of a complicated network of wiring in that house, if you know what I mean. So everything here is directional, frequency sensitive, and so on. You've got one fixed antenna at one location, and you're picking it up, and you're going to pick up one channel better than a hell of a lot of other channels. And maybe you pick up the low ones better than the high ones, or vice versa. So lots of variables involved. Where there is no ID on that television analog signal, it does strongly suggest it is a cable TV signal you're watching. I'm a little bit amazed that if you're watching a network channel, ABC, CBS, NBC, or whatever, over a cable system, that there would be no periodic identification. But I guess there's not. Maybe the identification is only shown as a test pad once in a while, and not announced in audio. That would amaze me. Because I don't own cable TV, I'm an over-the-air broadcast type person. I'm a little bit naive on this one, Joe. WHYY, KQLIW on the TechNet.
Watching something, I think, called the Food Network or something like that. So, of course, it's not an over-the-air broadcast channel, so why would it have to identify like an over-the-air broadcast channel? And the other channel, I think, was the S channel, which is kind of like baseball games and so forth. So that gave me the clue as far as what I thought of looking at. I can see lower BHM channels, but they're coming in much weaker, say, like channel 12, which is around 204 to 210. I can see that. It was a marginally viewable picture, but it was much, much weaker than the other with WHF. Now, I guess here's my problem. How do I approach these people? Because they use a trilithic type of detector. They think that's the name of it. The company makes it. And that thing is tuned to, I believe they told me previously, 139 megahertz. They're very concerned with frequency energy in that part of the band, either 137 or 139 megahertz. And being that they're looking there, they're not looking higher. If it seems like it passes there, they're happy because I had an issue with it before about leakage, and they came, checked it, and they said, we can't see leakage with our test equipment, so there's nothing we can do about it. We don't see a problem here, even though I can see it up in the higher of the UHF band. It's been an ongoing problem for actually a couple of years now, but now I have a T-antenna, I can take it down in different directions. I can get a pretty good idea of like what direction it's coming from as far as my house is concerned. And I can take my UHF board, which I'm talking about right now, and put the same frequency as this board, like, and I can walk across the street, and the signal gets much louder. I can actually hear the audio being recovered on the sound channel for those carriers. So it is something that's weak, but it's also very, very close to the phone pole connection across the street to me. But it may be coming from the person's house actually behind. I didn't go on their property and check it. But I don't know how I'm going to handle this problem. I guess I'm going to have to gather some more information on it and see what else I can figure out with this thing and so forth. But I thought once you had a leak or something like that, it would be kind of constant to be able